Telling Tales with Ms. G, and I want to honor veterans tonight, and I hope you do as well. So I have a few short stories about love, loss, and, of course, brotherhood, and everything that encompasses what it is to be a veteran, go to war, at least everything that everyone told me it is. So I hope that these stories hit that mark, and I hope you enjoy them. So I'll give you a moment to get settled and come right back here for Telling Tales with Ms. G at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. Stay tuned. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G here at 104.3 KTOO in Juneau. We're celebrating Veterans Day today. And with that note, I have a story by Christo Arbogast. It's titled Covenant. The mass of helmets lurched backward as the landing craft plunged into the dark water. Sea spray glistened on the surface of everything it touched, catching the light of the artillery fire. Private Eddie Hagen glanced at the faces of the men around him. Some were praying, while others held pictures, or mementos of sweethearts and family, before carefully tucking them away inside of their jackets. The rest stared into the unknown, their faces expressionless, betraying no inner feelings. "This is it, buddy." Eddie managed a smile in return for the hearty slap on his shoulder, and twisted around to acknowledge a friend. "We're finally going to kick some Nazi butt." Vince DeLanzio grinned down at Eddie. "Remember, kid, the rules are the same, just like it was in the old neighborhood. Stick with me. We'll both do just fine. Besides, your sister will never marry me if I let anything happen to you." "You know something, Vinny? That's really funny. She told me to watch out for you." Suddenly, both men were distracted by an explosion, which sent more spray into the craft. The roar of airplanes filled the sky. As they passed overhead, the black and white invasion stripes painted on their lower bodies could be seen. The markings let the Allies know that these were their own, for protection against their anti-aircraft guns. The soldiers watched them as they made their way through the flak and over the cliffs. "Son of a, do you see that shoreline, Vince? How the hell are we going to make it up those cliffs? We'll be sitting ducks, just waiting for Fritz to blow us all to hell." "They're blowing us all to hell now, bud. Personally, I'll take my chances on that beach than in this death trap. Look over there. At least two of these babies less than a mile off have sunk." Eddie attempted to adjust his gear and renewed his grip on his rifle. Amid the chaos and ever-increasing artillery fire, he thought of his last visit to another beach, Coney Island. During his high school years, as the weather grew warm, he would cut classes with Vince and hitchhike to the beach. Vince had always been the bolder one. Orphaned at an early age, he had been raised by an aunt. Without a father's guidance, he had grown up streetwise and cocky. On the other hand, Eddie had the advantage of a loving, structured family life. His dad was a kind and forgiving man. It was his mother's Irish temperament which had kept him on his toes. His sister, Tess, had the same fire and beauty as their mother. Vince had been smitten with Tess for years. In fact, Eddie was sure that his friend was in love. Vince and Eddie had signed up for the Marines at the same time, After basic training, the two had strutted like peacocks before family and friends. As full-fledged fighting men, they would now join in the fight against the Hun. When the time came to say goodbye, Eddie avoided the look in his parents' eyes. He could not avoid Tess, though. With tear-filled eyes, she made him promise to look out for himself, as well as Vince. She then turned to his friend, placed her hands on his shoulders, and kissed him for the first time. Vince watched her run upstairs to her room, leaving him weak in the knees. Regaining his composure, he said his farewell and walked out of the door. Suddenly, the barking of orders from the platoon leader interrupted Eddie's thoughts. The back wall of the craft crashed into the water, and the throng of men moved forward. Plunging into the icy surf, the Marines gasped as the cold wetness penetrated their clothing. The dark green depths caused many to flounder, already weighted down with excess gear. This, combined with the mortar fire aimed at them from the top of the cliffs, caused many to believe they had seen their last day. As Eddie struggled toward the shore, a bullet pierced through the man in front of him, causing him to fall backward. He looked into the lifeless eyes before the sea covered the soldier's face and claimed his spirit. A second later, Eddie felt a sharp pain in his side. Before losing his balance, he felt a strong arm lifting him up. "Are you okay, buddy?" Eddie shook his head in reply as Vince struggled to maintain his own bearing. The water became shallower, but rolls of barbed wire presented another problem. Others cried out in pain as they fell or tripped onto the biting barricade. Finally, the two spied an opening and scrambled to the shore, quickly followed by others. "Where are you hit, Ed?" Concern shone in Vince's face as his eyes searched for the source of the red stain, which slowly traveled downward. "Just beneath the shoulder. Man, it stung like hell at first. Now it's kind of numb." Eddie gasped and dropped his head onto the wet sand. "Give me your gear." Eddie raised his head as he felt his friend unbuckle the pack and ease the straps from his shoulders. "What are you doing, Vince?" "I want you to start crawling toward the cliff. See that niche over there? Head for it. You can't make it in your shape with all this gear. I'll be right behind you. Now go." The firing intensified, but Eddie said a silent prayer and clawed his way to the wall of rock. Bodies of dead and dying were all around. Ironically, they served as a protective shield. As he approached his destination, a hand reached out and grabbed at the collar of his jacket, pulling him to safety. Within the shelter of the rock, Eddie could see others inside the crevice. "Can you see my buddy?" "Don't see much of anything moving right now, mate." Eddie peered into the dark corners and recognized the British uniforms. A clicking sound engulfed his ears, and he realized that it was his teeth. Knowing he could not restrain his fear, he wanted at least to control his trembling. Glancing at the man next to him, he noticed that he, too, was shaking. The mist from the sea began to rise, only to mingle with the smoke from the mortar fire. Eddie lay against the cliff, feeling weak and helpless. More men were coming ashore and staying alive. They were making progress. He wondered how much longer the battle would last and where Vince was. Looking out at the edge of the beach, he saw the back of a familiar figure. With soldiers scrambling back and forth, Eddie found that he could not take his eyes from the lone form. Slowly, the man turned and faced Eddie's questioning stare. The left side of his face had been blown away with shrapnel. His arm hung limply at his side. Even with half of his body badly torn, Eddie knew that it was Vince. Both men looked at each other. Eddie could not speak or move. He could only gaze at the face of his friend. Finally, Vince turned and disappeared into the smoke and chaos of battle. "Sorry about your mate, Hank," Yank. "He'll probably turn up down the shoreline somewhere where we're supposed to be." The voice broke into Eddie's trance and pulled him back. Still, he could not speak. The look in Vince's eyes before he vanished played over and over again in Eddie's mind. It had been a look of satisfaction and knowing that his friend was safe and that he had kept his promise to the one he loved. It had also been a final farewell. Later on, as the medic finished dressing his wound, Eddie found himself lying in one of 100 rows of injured and dead soldiers. The glory of war was all around. Blood stained the sand, and the ongoing explosions of battle sounded in the distance. For now, though, the moans and crying of men filled the air. "Here, pal, have a cigarette." Eddie looked at the medic's face and murmured a thanks as he accepted the offer. Still trembling, he brought the cigarette to his lips and inhaled slowly. Lying back, he could only think of the fact that he was on a beach. It was chilly, just like Coney Island in the spring. Coney Island. He peered over just as a handful of more British soldiers made their way between the rows of bodies. One stopped to shift the weight of a load that he carried over his shoulder before resuming his journey. Eddie could see that it was the body of a young private, arms hanging limp and lifeless. The medic stopped the man and lifted the head of the boy. "You're wasting your time, Mac. This one's dead." Continuing his trek, the soldier replied over his shoulder, "I promised his mum that I would look out for him." Shaking his head, the medic turned his attention to the next link in an endless chain. Promised his mum. The words rolled over in Eddie's head. Promises. The entire beach was filled with broken promises. Yet Vince had managed to keep his. The cigarette slipped through his fingers into the sand. The sun now shone through the haze, resembling a Ferris wheel in the distance. Water lapped back and forth on the shore, and the cry of gulls somewhere phased into the laughter of children. Eddie closed his eyes and wept. That was Covenant by Christo Arbogast. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G here at 104.3 KTOO. I'll be right back. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G at 104.3 KTOO. We're honoring veterans today on this November 11th, Veterans Day. And I have another story for you. It's titled No Room in the Cemetery. It's actually a report from 1966. PFC Jimmy Williams' uniformed body was lowered in a grave in the Piney Woods of South Georgia Monday, while a grieving mother pondered the fates which denied him a final resting place in his hometown. And it may be that the 4,000 citizens of this little town 13 miles northeast of Montgomery are searching their collective conscience for an answer to why they could offer only a pauper's grave to their first casualty of the Vietnam War. "My son died fighting on the front for all of us. He didn't die a segregated death, and he'll not be buried in a segregated cemetery," Mrs. John Williams, mother of the Green Beret paratrooper, declared. City officials had claimed there was no room for the dead soldier in the segregated city cemetery. Mayor Dimp Thrash said the only plots available were for paupers in the rear of the burial grounds. Friends and neighbors of the 19-year-old youth who was killed in Vietnam May 19th, when grenade fragments ripped into his body, crowded funeral rites at the Newton Church of Christ in Montgomery Sunday. The flag-draped coffin was buried with full military honors in Anderson, Georgia National Cemetery, 100 miles from Wetumpka. It was the nearest available funeral site, an Army spokesman said. Mrs. Williams, a 38-year-old practical nurse, has filed a complaint with the Justice Department. Under the Public Facilities section of the Civil Rights Act, the government could take the case to court using the mother's complaint as grounds for entering the dispute. A spokesman for the Justice Department said the department would press the case despite the mother's decision to take the son to Andersonville. Mrs. Williams said she had reconciled herself to the distant burial. I don't have any animosity toward anyone. I couldn't love Christ, whom I cannot see, and hate the mayor. Whatever we sow, we shall reap. If they, the city officials, think they've done right, well, maybe they have, she said. I did not want my son buried in an out-of-the-way place for unknown people. My son was not a shoeshine boy like his father. He was a soldier, a paratrooper in the Green Berets. He was not fighting a second-class war and did not die a second-class death, the grief-stricken mother continued. I wanted him to be buried near his home because I know this is what he would have wanted, she added. Mrs. Williams says she has been unable to find work since three of her six surviving children entered previously all-white schools in Wetumpka last fall. The town's population includes some 1,500 Afro-American colored persons. Mr. Williams, 49, was a shoeshine boy for the mayor, a barber, 25 years ago. He currently works for a local glass company. Jimmy, the oldest of the seven Williams children, joined the Army 2 years ago upon graduating from high school. He was sent to Vietnam in February. Last Tuesday, his body, guarded by military men, was sent home for burial. A military survivor's assistant assigned to aid the Williams family, Lieutenant Robert L. Krasulki, said the only site he could acquire in the town was the pauper section. W.T. Goodman, the funeral director handling the arrangements, said there were no cemeteries exclusively for colored persons in the town. Someone, somehow, always found a plot for the deceased through friends or relatives. Many were buried in countryside cemeteries in the county, he revealed. The Reverend Fred Gray, who officiated at the funeral rites, accused city officials of being unconcerned about the death of their first casualty of the Vietnam War. Not until the burial furor arose did the city fathers bother to express condolences to the family, he said. Mayor Thrash said that at the present, the 200-year-old cemetery has slaves on one side and colored persons on the other and whites in the middle. We aren't going to dig up slave graves for anybody, he said. Thrash revealed plans for expansion of the cemetery. If they want to move the boy back, they're welcome to it, he said. Baltimore, June 4th, 1966. No room in the cemetery. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G, and we are telling tales of honoring our vets and good reasons why we always should. I'll be right back with more, so stay tuned here at 104.3 KTOO in Juneau, Alaska. Thank you. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G here at 104.3. And I'm telling tales tonight of veterans. And I have a story about the Cold Talkers, the secret heroes of World War II. When the 29 young Navajo men first stepped into the Marine recruiter's office one morning in 1942, none of them were sure what their futures would hold. All I thought when I went in the Marine Corps was going to give me a belt of ammunition and a rifle, a steel helmet, and a uniform, recalled Chester Nez in a 2004 interview with the National Museum of the American Indian, or NMAI. NAMI. Nez wasn't altogether wrong. He and his tribesmen would go on to fight in battles across the Pacific and European fronts, much like millions of other soldiers. But these courageous young men were destined for something different. Though they've received little acknowledgement for their work, the hundreds of Navajos and other Native American tribesmen in the U.S. military's Cold Talkers program helped pave the way for an Allied victory in World War II, using the tools of their own native languages and culture to keep America safe. The innovative military program was developed in 1942 when Philip Johnson, a white World War I veteran who had been raised on a Native American reservation, made a suggestion to the Marine Corps to help ensure the secrecy of communications during World War II by translating all messages into Native American languages. They could reduce the risk of interference from Japanese officials who were otherwise likely to crack their codes and use the secret information to defeat the Allied troops. After viewing a demonstration, the Marine Corps was impressed and immediately recruited 29 initial Navajo Code Talkers who were charged with the important task of developing a military code in their native language. Though some words in the military code were direct translations from English to Navajo and other tribal languages, other codes were more complex, using the tribal name of a type of animal to represent each letter of the alphabet. In some cases, too, the Native Americans would invent new words for military vocabulary that had no translation in their own languages. Well, when they first got us in there for Code Talkers, we had to work that out among our own selves. So we didn't have a word for tank, Charles Chibity, a Comanche Code Talker, told NMIA. And the one said, it's like a Comanche word, he said. It's just like a turtle, you know. It has a hard shell and it moves. And so we called it Wakari'e, a turtle. To the Marine Corps' surprise, the Code Talkers created and memorized the complex new military code almost immediately. The memorization process was simple, one of the initial Code Talkers, Carl Gorman, told the NMIA. For us, everything is memory. It's part of our heritage. We have no written language. Our songs, our prayers, our stories, they're all handed down from grandfather to father to children. And we listen. We hear. We learn to remember everything. It's part of our training. Code Talkers did more than simple language translation, though. These men fought in fronts all over the Pacific Islands and Europe, risking life and limb, watching friends and comrades die in battle. They held the fate of their country in their hands every day. The coded messages often included privileged information that could change the outcome of a battle in mere minutes. During the first 2 days of the Battle of Iwo Jima alone, the Code Talkers sent and decoded 800 messages relaying important military information to military officers. Thanks to the Code Talkers' fast and skillful work, the Axis forces never managed to intercept a single message from the Allied troops. The Japanese pulled all of their hair out trying to decipher the code, Nez told CNN. It's one of the hardest languages to learn. That's why it was never decoded or deciphered. Despite their essential role in the war, the heroic Code Talkers weren't acknowledged in the public sphere for over a quarter of a century. They were not even permitted to tell their own families about the work they had done to protect their country. When we got out, discharged, they told us this thing that you guys did is going to be a secret. When you get home, you don't talk about what you did. Don't tell your people, your parents, family. Don't tell them what your job was, said Chester Nez. This is going to be a secret. Don't talk about it. Just tell them you were in the service, defend your country, and stuff like that. But the code, never, never, don't mention, don't talk about it. Finally, in 1968, the military declassified the Code Talkers programs, and those who served have finally been honored for their service in wartime. In 2001, the surviving veterans of the Navajo Code Talkers program were presented with Congressional Medals of Honor. On the back of the medals was an inscription in the Navajo language. With the Navajo language, they defeated the enemy. Though few of the Code Talkers are still alive today, those who've spoken about their experiences serving in World War II have few regrets. I found that I was fighting for all the Indian people, all the people in the United States, all that we had, as we call the United States, said Navajo Code Talker Sam Chiso in a 2004 interview with NMAI. I found out this is what we were fighting for. That's a story on the Code Talkers, the secret heroes of World War II. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G, and I have one more story to read for you, and I'll be right back with that here at Telling Tales at 104.3 KTOO in Juneau. 1 second, please. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G here at KTO 104.3. I have one last story to give to you in honor of the Veterans Day. Soldier reunited with the dog who saved his life is the name of the story. While Sergeant Chris Duke, a National Guardsman, was serving in Afghanistan, he and his fellow troops made good friends with a few of the stray dogs, who the soldiers named Sasha, Target, and Rufus. So when the dogs had a chance to defend the soldiers, they didn't back down. One February night, an insurgent covered in explosives tried to enter the soldiers' quarters to kill the 50 men inside. But he didn't count on the dogs. The three strays began barking and biting the suicide bomber, trying to keep him from harming the people inside. When his explosives detonated, he was killed. But all of the American troops remained safe. Sadly, one of the dogs, Sasha, was severely injured by the bomb and had to be euthanized. But both Rufus and Target survived the assault and were celebrated as heroes by the soldiers they had saved. When Duke finished his tour of duty and returned home the following month, he wanted to bring his loyal friend Rufus along, but military regulations wouldn't allow it. So after returning to Atlanta, Duke wrote to a veterans assistance group, Hope for the Warriors, asking for their help to bring the two dogs overseas. This was going to mean a lot to him, the group's president, Robert Kellyer, told CBS. So whatever we needed to do to get this wish done, we were going to do that. Another grassroots group, launched on Facebook, raised over $21,000 to pay for the dogs to be flown to the United States. Now Target has been transported to Arizona to live with another soldier, and Rufus has just arrived in Atlanta, where he'll live out the rest of his days with Duke and his family. Duke is thrilled to make the commitment to care for Rufus for the rest of his life. In his eyes, it's the least he could do for his furry friend. I firmly believe I wouldn't be here today if it weren't for him. This has been Telling Tales with Ms. G, and this is Veterans Day. You see a veteran, know a veteran, tell them thank you. Until next time, good night.